What? Y'all don't go right to work when you get there, do you? My name is Charlie Parker. I am a very grateful recovered alcoholic. I've had the gift of sobriety since March 22nd of 1985, and I am truly grateful for that. I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say tonight. I'm giving a bunch of good talks sitting right over there in that chair. I don't know what's going to come out tonight, but my home group, my home group is the primary purpose group in Austin, Texas. We invite you to come visit us on Tuesday night if you're ever in Austin on a Tuesday night. We meet at 7:30 and we study the Big Book week after week, and it's a lot more fun than it sounds like. There was a time when I wouldn't have wanted to go to a Big Book meeting, especially one that takes 2 years to get through, from doctor to doctor. But we have about 175, 180 people show up every Tuesday night for a Big Book study meeting, and it tells me that that real alcoholics are hungry for solution in our fellowship, and I think AA is making a big comeback in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for that you can applaud yourself. Yeah. Been through a lot of changes with my sponsor. I've been sponsored by Jim Fletcher and then Myers for a while, and then I was with Mark Houston. And I was going to be a lot stronger than tonight. And then I'm back with Myers now. I greatly admire some of our speakers that have been up here tonight. But we lost Mark, and I'm going to talk about Mark. I don't have to warn you anymore. I usually have to tell you that I'm a big guy and I ride Harleys and I shoot shotguns and all that stuff, but I'm liable to cry like a little girl in a pink dress up here at any moment. And I swear there are times I think, come on, Charlie. I mean, it's been almost 2 years since Mark died. February will be 2 years, and when do we cross from sorrow into self-pity? And, Mark wouldn't want you to, and I go, okay, I think I got it. I think it's going to be different this time. And Mike Lorenz said something in the room when we were walking down the hall yesterday, and I tried to quote it to Katie in the room when it was just me and Katie, and both eyes went, and I was like, probably better not try to tell that one, huh? we're going to talk about a lot of stuff. You met my wife, Katie. She spoke here last year. She did step three, and for any of y'all that were here, I'm a big fan of hers. And, AA is really alive and well in our house, I can't tell you how grateful I am for the level of AA discussions that go on in our house. And she's my best friend and a frequent source for me. I go to her with 10th step stuff a lot, and we're going to talk about the 10th step tonight. But, sometimes I say she's kind of like getting a drink from a fire hose, sometimes when you ask Katie for input, you get a little more than you were hoping for, I don't know. I like to say that I'm some of Katie's best work, I don't know what it says in yours, but in my Big Book it says my very life as an ex-problem drinker depends upon my constant thought of Katie and how I can help meet her needs. I hope to get into the story about Katie later on. We have quite a history, but. My gosh, before I go any further, I want to thank the committee. I want to thank Bob. Bob is a dear friend of mine, and I don't take that relationship lightly. And the committee that had anything, Bud and Kim and all you folks, Mark, everybody that has something to do with this deal coming together, I want to thank you for it. Because, I know that a deal like this doesn't just fall together. There's people that have done a lot of hard work to get this thing to come together. And I also know there's a lot of people that didn't do a darn thing, but have a lot of ideas about how it could have been done just a little bit better. If it's like, that's the fellowship I crave, and for those folks, we got a position on the committee for next year. But I'm real happy to be here, and it's funny because, getting to speak here, It's nervy, but it's a huge honor. I mean, you know, I know you're supposed to say, and Bob has told me that humility is something that it's important to learn to fake early on in your recovery. And you know, you're supposed to be able to, you know, say, no, it's an honor to clean the ashtrays, and it's an honor to make coffee, and it is. It's an honor to be involved in AA at any level. But speaking of state line is a little better than cleaning ashtrays, you know. I mean, let's face it, you know. I mean, you know, we're supposed to check our ego at the door and all that stuff. But I, some of my heroes I've heard speak and in this have spoken at state line. Some of them are here tonight, and I still remember the first time. And Katie and I have been to everyone but the first one, and you know, it's funny the way we Bob Bazans and had a lot to do, had everything to do with us meeting Bob Darrell. I mean, Katie and I were coming to Vegas one time, and I was talking to Bob on the phone. I said, we're going to Vegas next week. And he goes, oh, you should call my friend Bob out there. And that started, that little introduction, it was no big deal to Bob, was a big deal to us. Because now all of a sudden, we're moving down a train of people that are serious about working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope to get around to speaking to some of that later. I should warn you in advance, I'm a little excited, and I got a little ADD working up here. So there are times when I'll say we're going to get back to that later in the talk. And what that means is that this is not the proper time to introduce that piece into the talk. But when I tell you we're going to get back to it later, we're probably not coming back. I always get real excited when I actually circle back around to one, you know, but usually it's just off in the vapor, little bunny trails of, you know, here and there. But, you know, it's funny. I mean, the speakers, Carla is a good friend of ours. Carla spoke Thursday night, and then Carl did it. I could listen to Carl once a week doing step one. I thought it was just tremendous. And then Marilyn last night, and, the Bazans family, that panel, the level of honesty and openness that was exhibited in that panel is something you only see in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a real honor to get to witness it. I haven't seen Peter in 20 years, and I don't have time to tell this story, but I'm going to tell it anyway. You talk about these little goosebump stories. I mean, I was fairly new in sobriety. I was four and a half years sober. And I went to a conference, and I'd blown up a marriage, and we were in the middle of a really ugly divorce, and the speaker was this Bob B. from St. Paul, Minnesota. And he got up there, and he talked, and I've been to a lot of conferences. I'm a conference guy. I like conferences. I like going to people. I like conferences. So, you know, people don't come to conferences to get their court card signed. I mean, it's generally people that like this program and that are involved in this program that are attending these kind of things. But I'd never wanted to speak to the speaker before. In fact, I mean, talk about a self-centered jackass. I mean, I was at a Lone Star Roundup one time, and Lois Wilson was down at the front, and I didn't even bother to walk down to the front and shake her hand. You know, I mean, that's the kind of self-centeredness I carry around. There was an old woman down front. There were young women in the lobby. It was no contest, you know. But on this occasion, there was 3,000 people in the room, and it felt like Bob was speaking directly to me. And I came home, and I had a cell phone in my truck, and that's back when that was a big deal. You know, it's the big thing that was wired in, you know, and all that stuff. And I'm trying to think, you know, you had to dial, to get long-distance information, you had to dial the area code 555-1212, and I didn't know. First of all, how do you spell Bazans, for God's sake? I mean, you know, you can spell it 19 different ways, and I'm thinking, so I can't really call information. I don't really know the area code for St. Paul, Minnesota, but I wanted to talk to this guy. It was on me. I couldn't get it off of me. And then Sunday I come home. Of course, I didn't walk down and ask him for his phone number. I just wanted to talk to him. And I go back to Austin. This took place in Dallas. I drive 200 miles to Austin. He goes home. That Tuesday night, I go to my big book study meeting, and there's this red-haired guy that comes in. I've never seen him before. He says, is anybody here from out of town? And he says, my name's Bill. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. I thought, well, he'll at least know the area code. You know, I mean, you know. So I walk up to him after the meeting, and I said, you're from St. Paul? He goes, yeah. I said, you don't happen to know a guy named Bob Bazans, do you? And he goes, yeah, he's my dad. And he says, He says, excuse me, I got to go to the bathroom. And I'm like, that's okay, I got to sit out. You know, I mean, I'm a little weak. And you know, and Bob essentially sponsored me through that divorce, not very tenderly. It was, we had some very direct conversations, you know. I mean, there were times when, I just remember a couple that were very direct. There was one where he said, call me tomorrow at 6:30, and I went to the 5:30 meeting, and, you know, pretty good meeting, and I come home, and I call him about, you know, 10 minutes to 7, and he says, in the future, when I tell you to call me at 6:30, I'm going to expect you to call me at 6:30. And I said, well, you know, I was at the meeting, and you should get points for it being at a meeting, right? I mean, and he goes, well, I left a meeting early and canceled two appointments to be here at 6:30 for your phone call. So in the future, I'd appreciate it if you tell me you're going to call me at 6:30. I'll call you at 6:30. I'm like, okay. And then there was another time where I had called her the one name you don't call women, and you can't walk the dog backwards from that point. And I called him up, and I was kind of proud of myself because I'd called her up and apologized for it, you know. And he goes, I'm not real impressed with guys with 5 years of sobriety that are having to run around and make amends all the time. I was like, damn, you just can't get anything from this guy. But anyway, that was 20 years ago, and it's been a long friendship, and it's great to see you here in the room tonight, Bob. And you know, I don't, and well, we had Ralph. Oh my God, Ralph, just knocked it out of the park, buddy. I mean, you know, and then Frank gets up here. Talk about slipping you a crippler. I mean. This guy gets up and says, oh, don't worry about me. I'm going to lower the bar. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to bring very much. And boom! You know, I mean, and I'm like, oh, good. Yeah, good, Frank. That a boy. You know, and then I just love Mike Lorenz. He's one of my favorite people in the world, you know. So, I mean, all these wonderful speakers, it's great for the conference. It's just great for the conference. It's great for everybody's recovery. Not so hot when you're the 4 o'clock speaker, you know. That's I'm kind of waiting for somebody to lay an egg, you know. But it's anyway. Let's move on. It was a lot of fun, and it's just been great. I do have to say, how many people are here for your first State Line Conference? Just by a show of hands, welcome. All right, we're glad you're here. I don't want to sound, you know, us old timers in AA are a little. You know, a little romantic about our memories and stuff. And I don't want to sound like the guy that had to walk uphill in the snow 2 miles to school, you know, every day. But you really miss something not going to Whiskey Pete's. I'm telling you, I've been thrown into better places than that. We're having dinner one night and a slab of the meat falls in my lap and started humping my leg. You know, I mean... So, I think this conference has come a long way. Ralph, thank you for lowering the bar. I can tell jokes like that now. You know, yesterday, Bob has, there's a guy that wanted to read inventory, and he wanted to do it with a woman, and Bob sets him up with my wife, and she actually heard inventory from this guy yesterday. Of course, that was before I found out today what it means to do a fourth and fifth step with somebody, so... I got some new questions, you know. Kind of friends I got. Let's get rolling. I'm supposed to talk about step 10 tonight. I'm supposed to tell a little bit of my story. You know, this isn't exactly a big book workshop, but it's not really just, you know, I like to tell a little bit about my story so you know that I didn't just wind up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous by mistake. But I grew up. A lot like a couple of other speakers tonight, I grew up in a pretty good household, you know. I mean, I don't know what a dysfunctional family is, but ours was, I mean, nobody was drinking in my house. Nobody was knocking each other around. Both of my parents were getting up and going to work every day, and they both loved both of us kids like crazy. And they were there for all the events. They were there for everything. They were doing the flashcards and the making the Christmas ornaments and all the stuff that I don't turn out to be very good at. But... I did grow up under the burden of potential. My mother was a first grade school teacher for 42 years, and I heard an awful lot about my potential growing up. My mother had a way of moving just that one finger when she would talk to you. You know, and she would say, "You drink every day." And I remember thinking, everybody I know drinks every day, you know, but this thing about potential, I just kept hearing about it when I was a kid. You know, it's like, you know, why can't you be more like Charles Mollier? Why can't you, you know, be like the guy across the street, you know, and apply your potential? You could be so much if you just live up to your potential. And I remember thinking, thanks, Mom, but I'm really not holding back that much, you know. I'm flattered by the comment, but you're kind of getting my best shot. But I will tell you that 12 years of heavy drinking and heavy use of outside issues will significantly lower people's expectations of you. I mean, you know what? I used to say that like it was a joke, but sometimes I wonder how much that had to do with getting people off of me, because it felt like they were on me pretty bad, and the bar was set pretty high. And after drinking out the way I drank for a while, it was just like, just get a job. You know, don't worry about a career or a profession or being a superstar anymore. Just get off the couch, for God's sake. You know, and I mean, I was so poorly treated as a child, I should tell you, that I finally ran away from home for good at the age of 28. I'm serious. Never went back. But I was in and out for a while, but I didn't start drinking until I was about 16, and I probably didn't need this fellowship till I was about 17, you know, I mean, so I had a pretty good year of controlled, you know, managed drinking, but I'm a big book guy, there are very few lines in the big book that don't apply to me real heavily, but there is one where it says our stories are filled with countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like normal men. I don't have very much experience with that. I have very little experience with trying to drink like normal men. The culture that I came from, the 60s have been mentioned. I was kind of a 60s wannabe. I was born in 1956, so I really was kind of a punk kid in the 60s. I missed the free love and got in time for the drugs and alcohol, you know. It was all about getting loaded for me. Alcohol was never a beverage to me. It was always a drug delivery system. And every time I drank, from the first time I drank, I knew something had happened very special in my life. And I knew that something had soothed something that I didn't even know was bothering me. And from that day until, it would be real macho to stand up here and tell you that from the time I was 16 until the time I was 28 when I stopped drinking, that I drank a fifth of whiskey every day or whatever, that wouldn't be true. But the thing I can tell you is absolutely true from my experience, and this is not everybody's experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some people held it together a lot better than I did. But I can tell you from my experience that from that time, from 16 to 28, I never turned down the opportunity to get loaded one time under any circumstances. There was never one time where somebody would pull something out and I would say, it's my mother's birthday today or something like that. It was at the center of my life, and anything that, you know, there was nothing that was going to get between me and getting loaded. And so by the time I got here, I was an extreme case. Well, I got a lot of ground to cover today. So, I came to AA just by a bizarre set of circumstances. And it started getting ugly. And like a lot of our speakers have talked about, I wish I had more time to tell drinking stories, and some of those outside issue stories are the really funny ones. But I mean, it started getting really sloppy, and things started getting out of control. I mean, one night I left a bar in a blackout one night, and there was a collision. My car impacted another car. Well, Katie thinks it's important for me to say it was my mother's car. I wrecked every car my mother ever owned, and this night I was driving the nerd wagon, I called it. She had this brown station wagon that I swear you could be doing Mach 5 with two strippers tied to the roof and you wouldn't get pulled over in this car. I mean, it was the most low-keyed car. I called it the nerd wagon, and I mean, you could be at 3 o'clock in the morning and the police were going to go, "Oh, he's suffered enough, let him go," you know. But I rammed this car into a police car one night. I mean, oh, darn it, I blew the punchline. Well, that good. That's the short version of the story, because I rammed it into a police car one night. And you know, if you had a different, if it had gone a little differently, and Norm Alpa used to like to say that our lives were saved and changed by seconds and inches. I got a lot of breaks out there drinking. I mean, you know, if those cops had been standing there writing a ticket when I came down that street tonight, you could still have a different speaker tonight. You know, I got really lucky a lot of times, and I dodged a lot of bullets, and I came out of blackout one night, squared off against five banditos. That's the one percenters there in Texas, and I was in a very vulnerable position. We were behind a building, and between a building and a brick wall, and one of them had a timing chain belt, and the other one had a sawed-off shotgun. It was about that long. That'll bring you out of a blackout. And I managed to leave, but I got arrested. And that wasn't an extraordinary night. That's just a day in the life of Charlie Parker. I mean, you know, I lost the power of choice and control very early in my drinking. I like to talk about the pawn shops a lot of times. I like to pawn stuff. I love going to pawn shops. Any other pawn shoppers here tonight? My people. You know, and the thing I loved about the pawn shops was the purity and the simplicity of the equation. You know, you never went into a pawn shop and had them go, "Good God, man, what are you going to do with this money?" You know, or you know, "Weren't you just in here this morning?" Or, you know, something like nothing. You give them the shotgun, and they give you the money, and you leave, and you come back with a deer rifle. Now, I got to be sure not to forget to point out that I didn't own very much stuff. So I had to pawn stuff that didn't belong to me. And that creates hard feelings in your family and friends. But, you know, we alcoholics make some wonderful plans. We do. I mean, you know, and our plans work right up till they stop working. You know, and I mean, we make plans that you could carry over to the college professor and they'd look it over and go, "That's a damn good plan." You know, I mean, the plan for this was to pawn everything, and you had 3 months to get everything out of the pawn shop. And those jumbotrons really do put on 60 pounds, don't they? I should really turn around and let you see this chimp's ass on the back of my head. You know, where was I? So the plan was you had 90 days to get everything out of the pawn shop, and I could usually pull a scam within 90 days and get everything out, except for this one time when I came out of a 5-day blackout. I was a blackout drinker. I thought everybody was a blackout drinker, but not everybody was. Katie was a brownout drinker, but it turns out she was vulnerable in ways that I never thought about if she went into a blackout. So it was much more important to her to keep a lid on what was going on when she's out there drinking. For me, it was just all out, and I blacked out several times a week. And on this occasion, I came out of a blackout. I'd been in a blackout. I didn't have many of these, though. I'd been blacked out for 5 days. And I don't remember anything except for one incident during that 5 days. And I had $8 in my pocket, and I still had all of those pawn tickets. You know, I had pulled an insurance scam that was supposed to get everything out of the pawn shop, and I just stopped by to have a couple of drinks. And I didn't know that I was triggering a phenomenon of craving. We didn't use that language. I mean, I don't ever remember walking into the Spillway pub there in East Dallas and going, "Oh, Bobby, spiritual malady's been on me all day today, ain't it? I have been struggling with a mental obsession that has made me powerless over taking the first drink, and I know when I take it, I'm going to trigger a phenomenon of craving." You know, I just needed a drink, you know, and I stopped in to have a couple of drinks, and I came out of a 5-day blackout, and I had all the pawn tickets, and I hadn't gotten anything out of the pawn shop, and I would have to go to my dad, who was a good man, and say, "Dad, if we act now, I can get you a pretty good deal on all your stuff." But if we wait till tomorrow, it's strictly retail. And for you Al-Anons out there, we know that's not funny. We know that's not funny. I have to tell that like it's funny, or it'll be one more case of me bawling like a little girl up here. But, you know, the thing about it is I remember the desperation of getting in the truck with him and going around to all these pawn shops. I live in Austin now, but this was in Dallas, and it's a big spread-out town, kind of like L.A., and it wasn't just going to the pawn shop. It was, we got to go out on Beltline and get your deer rifle, and out to Garland Road to get the coin collection. Your metal detectors are out in Oak Cliff, and then down in East Grand is the shotgun, and it was all day in the car with me and my dad and all that shame. And I remember riding along with him saying, "Dad, I swear to God, I will never do this again." And I meant it with every fiber of my being. What I didn't know was that I didn't have the power. Just like Chad read about there earlier, I did not have the power to make good on that promise. So that's how slick I was when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how cool I was. I was a burden to my family and everybody that was unfortunate enough to know me or love me. So to say that I'm grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a little bit of an understatement. You know, I came to AA because I had moved off to Austin to go to college again. It's bull. There was a thing in my mom's credit union newsletter saying they had reactivated student loans, so they gave me $2,500 to go down and party in Austin. You know, I mean, I was enrolled in college, but I mean, the money was in my pillowcase in case I needed it, and I partied until I got arrested. But during that time, there was the maintenance man at these apartments, and he kept talking about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he didn't talk about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me get that straight. He kept talking about treatment. He kept telling me about treatment, treatment, treatment. You need to go to treatment. My wife went to treatment. If you go to treatment. And he didn't ever talk about detox. He never talked about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I thank that treatment center for introducing me to you guys. That's the best thing that treatment center did, was separate me from alcohol in a safe environment. And they put us all in a van and they brought me to you guys. And I fell in love with you guys from the very beginning. I'm not a guy that struggled with the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I loved it from the very beginning. I love drunks. I loved them when I was drinking. I love them now. There is an energy level between drunks. On page 18, it talks about that identification that takes place when one alcoholic works with another. And it's so important that it says, until such an identification is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. That's how strong that identification is. So when I meet guys like Gordon here, you know, or Mike or some of these guys, I'm like, the highest compliment I can pay somebody is to go, "Oh, I'd have drank with that guy." You know, I mean, and, you know, sometimes when we fly in to speak somewhere, they'll say, "We're going to send, Bud out to pick you up at the airport." And you get on the phone with Bud, and he goes, "Listen, I'm going to be," I go, "Don't even tell me. Don't even tell me. Just be at the bottom of the escalator." And it's amazing how many times you can come down the escalator and go, "That's our boy right there." You know, I mean, because we're just drawn to each other on an energy level. That's how strong that identification is. And Clancy talks about it better than anybody I've ever heard, saying that when that identification is there, and you're telling me that you've recovered from something that I believe I've got, I'm willing to take actions that I may not yet believe in. And, you know, that's what happened. But the thing is, I came to AA and I thought I was a big book guy. I thought I was doing, you know, I really did. I mean, I was reading the big book and we were going to the meetings and that sort of thing. But I missed an awful lot. I missed a lot of the stuff that's in the big book. And I don't know what I would do when I would read it. But, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I like to read this stuff and look for things that I agree with. Right? I work a lot with in my new recovery, and I hope to get around to talking about some of that. I know I will. But I like to read the book and look for things that I agree with, you know. So when I'm reading the book, I work a lot with this thing called the set-aside prayer. It came from our lineage, the same lineage that Mike Lorenz came from, and some of it. And Don used to, he came up with the idea. Joe was the one that brought it to fruition. But it basically is something the words to the effect of, "God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about the big book, the fellowship, the steps, myself, and even you, God, so that I could have a new experience. Please help me see the truth." Because if you're a guy like me, sometimes what I think I know stands in the way of the truth. Because I'll read this book and I'll go, "Oh yeah, here's that part where it says that, you know, and oh yeah, I remember this part. You can't tell me anything about this one. I've got this one underlined and highlighted, you know, but sometimes I do stuff with the set-aside prayer, and new information just jumps off the page at me where I go, "What did I used to do when I read that? You know, I mean, did I just shine it on?" Well, we missed an awful lot. And I had this sponsor that was really giving it his best shot. And he taught me an awful lot about principles and how to be a man in recovery and how to say what you're going to do and do what you're going to say. And I had to do things if for no other reason than because I'd told people that I was going to do it. He made me show up for stuff and sign up for stuff and that sort of thing. He wasn't the biggest step technician in the world. But I'll tell you one thing. Sponsorship is not optional in this program. Somewhere along the line, it became okay for people to go, well, I don't really like sponsoring people, or I'm really not good at sponsoring people. What? Like you were really good at writing inventory when you got here? You know, it's been said here before, we do this stuff, we learn it as we're doing it. But I'll tell you this much, it's very comforting to know that there are a lot of people out there staying sober off of imperfect sponsorship. I firmly believe in my heart that if the sponsor and the sponsee are both giving it their best shot, God takes up a lot of slack in that occasion, in that equation. So don't wait till you got this deal down perfectly to start sponsoring people. I mean, I sponsor differently now than I did 5 years ago. You know, there's stuff that I see in the book now that I keep incorporating into the work and that sort of thing that I wasn't doing, you know, when I was working with Adel or you know, and now I've got a bunch of sponsees here tonight. There's about 10 of us here. And I love you guys. And I'm glad you're here. It's a big honor to get into, and you know, I know I'm going to get around to talking about one of them, but I'm especially fond of those two that got up here and read tonight, but I'm especially fond of all of them. But, you know, I got to get moving here because can I have another 30 minutes? You know, there's a, that first pass through the steps, I didn't know it, but I was working the steps as if the problem was alcohol. You know, to say that I missed an awful lot, you know, I was working the steps as if alcohol was the problem, but if you were looking at me, Charlie was running the show, right? And God was more like a troubleshooter for me. And I didn't know that I'd hitched my wagon to middle of the road AA or that I was doing meeting based sobriety or anything like that. I thought I was doing AA. You know, I'm going to the meetings and I'm doing listening. You know, quick, somebody say what I need to hear, and you know, and I'm in there talking about my problems. And even at my sickest, all I could do was go in and make you laugh. You know, and if nothing else, we just laugh about how sick we were. And you know, well, I hope to talk about some of it. But I kept hitting the wall in sobriety. I hit the wall at 4.5 years when I hooked up with Bob. I was in a lot of trouble when I talked to Bob. Bob was the first one I ever heard talking about problems in sobriety, significant living problems as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what people were saying, but what I was hearing was that I had all these problems, and then I came through those doors, and it's been nothing but caring and sharing ever since. You know, and I'm out there. I'm a maniac. I mean, I'm constant collision. You know, and so when you were talking about working through significant problems, it was significant. That's why I wanted to talk to this guy, and that's why, you know, we wound up hooking up. But I kept hitting the wall, and I hit the wall at 4.5 years of sobriety. I hit the wall at 7 years of sobriety, and I hit the wall again at 17 years of sobriety. I had my most significant spiritual awakening 17 years into sobriety. And that is what I really want to get around to talking about, because as I'm going along, I got into this marriage. I'd blown up two marriages, and I got into another one with this. It was a commuting marriage between New York City and Austin. And from the outside, it's funny. The most dishonest, phoniest marriage of my life is the one that my mother was the most proud of, because she likes outward appearances, and this one looked pretty good from the outside. We had a penthouse apartment in Manhattan. We had a beach house in the Hamptons. She had a 7-figure job, and we were going to the south of France and all these places. And you know, but it was Katie, I should point out, and I were litter mates. We both came into AA about the same time, and she was married the whole time that I knew her, and we were best friends, literally best friends, like brother and sister for 20 years. And there was zero sexual innuendo, zero flirtation. It was like my kid's sister, and we were very, very close. And she had witnessed all these marriages and didn't approve of any of them, but, But what had happened was after I'd blown up the one at 2.5, I got into one at 2.5 that blew up at 4.5 years. I got into another one 2 weeks after that one, not married, but got into that relationship 2 weeks after. I thought that was a pretty good grieving period. And then I blew that one up, and then I went, so I thought, well, I've been knocked to the mat every time, and I went into this other one, and what had happened was when I hit that wall at 7 years of sobriety, I pulled back from AA. And I thought, you know what? I've tried doing it your way, and I'm getting screwed every time I step. I'm getting knocked to the mat every time I step in the ring. So now I'm going to go back and I'm going to get mine, and I'm going to, you know, because I, you know, half measures avail me nothing in my butt. I'm going to get what I need, and I'm, you know, and I married this really wealthy woman, and it was, I mean, but 12 years that deal went on. And one night we chartered a plane to fly from the Hamptons into New York City, and we were in a plane crash. We crashed into the water at night, and I was on CNN, and I survived, in case you're wondering. An event like that will make you look at things differently in your life, you know. And I started looking at things differently, and I called up this guy. I knew by that time that I was unbelievably self-centered. Turns out it's mentioned in our book. We're going to get to that in a minute. But I remember calling up John Henry, this old-timer there in Austin. I said, John Henry, I am so self-centered that I just have to force myself to go, hey, Carl, how are the kids? You know, and act like I give a flip about the answer, because I don't, you know. I mean, I am so self-centered that all I want to talk about is me. And when you talk, it just reminds me of something else about me I'd rather be talking about. Katie and I talk about this thing called story stealing. I'm going to give you this one. This is a fun tool in recovery. It's called story stealing. And when you're self-centered and self-obsessed, this is all over the place. Story stealing is what Katie pointed out to me. She's very generous with her input. That I was a big story stealer. And what story stealing is, we're at a party and somebody walks up and says, hey, I'm going to Costa Rica this weekend. And I go, Costa Rica? I've been to Costa Rica 3 times. I went down there with 10 of my buddies from Newport Beach. We went down there, you know, we whitewater rafted, we went fishing, we did all the, we rented dirt bikes and went riding around in the coffee plantations. And I tell my Costa Rica story, and then I spin on my heel and I walk off. And this poor bastard's standing there. He didn't get to tell his Costa Rica story because I stole it, right? You know, and so watch for story stealing in your AA community. It's rampant, you know. I can't tell you how many times people come up to us and they go, oh, everybody at the treatment center is going, that's story stealing, that's story stealing, you know. But he was all over me, you know. And so what happened was John Henry got me to go down. He said, meet me tomorrow at 3:15 and we're going to go out to the treatment center and talk to the guys. And I remember thinking, no, you know, that doesn't, because when service work is what you need the most, it sounds the least appealing, you know. You know, because these guys are going to want to talk about themselves, and I want to talk about me. But I'm telling you, and I should point out that this whole time I considered myself an AA member, and I was very much about not drinking and about being sober. And, you know, I was scared to death of drinking. I never took any medication. I've had 3 surgeries with no anesthesia or any kind of painkiller or anything. I mean, you know, even my doctor, when they did the liver biopsy, and I did it without any anesthetic except for local, the doctor was tripping. At one point he goes, you mind if I ask what that felt like? You know, it's kind of like being stabbed, you know, but you know, what happened was, one page down, Katie, we started doing this thing, and I met this guy named Mark Houston, and, you know, it was a very strange series of events, you know, because a guy called me, and he said, I hear about a Big Book study that's coming to Dallas. That's 200 miles away, but I knew people there, and this guy sends down a flyer, and I took it to Katie, and, you know, I'll never forget, Mark one time was out on the back porch with Katie, and he goes, you really think you had anything to do with being at that workshop? You know, I mean, you two were channeled in a direction to be right at that workshop, because I came to Katie and I said, I don't think this is what Dick was looking for, but this might be something we're interested in. Because as I started doing work with these new guys, I realized that in some areas I was a step ahead of them. You know, I'm telling them, I'm 17 years sober, but I'm telling them, go home and read the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. And I'm going home and reading the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. And, you know, and I'm going back through the work myself, but I'm getting with people that are interested in talking about this stuff. And we're talking about, what do you do when they say this? And have you ever heard of the bedevilments? And, you know, and all this stuff. And, no, where is that? Page 52, it turns out. You know, and all this stuff. You know, when I say I'd missed a lot, I was pretty excited, though, about this new deal. And you're starting to see it have some effect in my life and in their life. And we wind up with this thing with Mark Hughes. Houston, and I will never forget it. I mean, he was talking at one point, and Katie and I are looking at each other going, what book is he reading from? You know, I have never heard any of this stuff before. And the coolest thing now is to be talking somewhere at a treatment center or something and have these guys that have been bouncing in and out of AA for 15 or 18 years come up to you and go, the stuff you're saying, I have never heard before. That's the power of this message, and that's the power of our common solution. That's why I'm a big book guy, because I spent 17 years in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous trying to live off a meeting-based sobriety, and it almost killed me. I survived it. A lot of us don't. For a lot of us, meeting-based sobriety will keep me sober right up to the point that I drink or kill myself. You know, so sometimes I see guys go, well, I mean, everything is going fine. You know, it's working. I go, well, it's where everything's fine at your house. But the more you get involved in this work, the more you see the ones of us that come around and we stick around just long enough to go nuts in sobriety and we leave. You know, so I'm always excited when we get somebody that has been around for a while to get them involved in this work and to be able to tell them that there is a new experience available as a work out of this book. Now I'm getting way out of my head, but the thing I'm ahead of myself, but what I did find out when we started working with Mark and working with his stuff, that there are folks that are doing this deal at another level. There were people that were doing this program. Some of them are in the room tonight. You know, I mean, these are people that were really into doing the deal. And it was very, very exciting, you know. But I had this new big awakening in working with Mark and in working, you know, with Chris and Myers and Bob. And for God's sake, I mean, let me tell you, before I forget to say it, I want to celebrate the tapers. I want to celebrate these two guys that are in the back of the room recording these talks, because I'm telling you, a ton of my recovery came from driving around in my truck and listening to CDs of people that knew more about this stuff than I did. I got a 12-inch subwoofer in my truck, and I'm driving around listening to Bob D. from Las Vegas, for God's sake, you know, and he doesn't even rap, you know, I mean, but I mean, there were times when I'd hear Mark say stuff. There's a time with Bob, I have a very clear memory of Bob saying something one time, and I was listening to it on the CD, and I was stopped, and I was like, my God, I was sitting there when he said that, and I didn't hear it. You know, so the CDs I'm a big fan of, you know, putting those things in and you listen to them more than once and you find it. Well, so Katie and I have really been on fire with this deal. And so my job tonight, with what time I have left, is to talk about step 10. Did I set that up okay, Mike? I mean, you know, I was like, well, 43 minutes set up for step 10. That's pretty good, Charlie. I told Katie, I was like, honey, I'm afraid I'm going to run out of something to talk about. She's like, oh, right. Yeah, that's your real problem, Charlie. I'm a big book guy. I love the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. All this is right here is the first 164 pages of a large print big book that my sponsor got hold of and ripped the stories out of the back. And I put a leather binding on it. It's one of my most prized possessions. But the reason I like it is on page 29, it says later on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. This book promises me clear-cut directions on how to do what these first 100 people did. These people thought it was so important. They knew they had discovered something that was a big deal with these people recovering, and they were doing it exactly by this process, and they thought it was important enough that they found it necessary to put it down in a book. And it talks about this common solution. It says the common problem is one thing that holds us together, but the common solution is what binds us. And the idea back then was that we should all be practicing the common solution. Lately, I've been seeing a sentiment, and it's not as bad as it was 10 or 15 years ago, but there's there's almost a sentiment against the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous in the rooms of AA sometimes. It's almost like it's uncool to talk about the Big Book or to quote the Big Book or to say, you know, well, and this is what it says in the book, and people roll their eyes, you know, and that sort of thing. There's meetings where you're not really welcome, you know, with the Big Book in there, you know. I don't get it. You know, I don't get it. I don't think our founders ever saw a time that we would be, you know, that we would go from being a recovery program with a support fellowship that somehow over 75 years, if we're not careful, we'll migrate into a sobriety fellowship with an optional program. You know, come to the meetings, and if it gets really bad, you can work the steps, but take your time and that sort of thing. I don't get it. I'm about getting guys through the steps rapidly. I'm about getting them in touch with the solution, the way it's lined out in the book, getting them through that process. I mean, sometimes people act like these Big Book thumpers are people that study the book and they don't work it, you know, but they don't talk it. I don't see that as a big problem. I haven't seen that as the big problem in AA. I see it more, the big problem is people that aren't doing it all, that aren't reading it at all, and we're just going to the meetings and they're dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're going back out and people are going, well, I guess they weren't ready, you know. Well, maybe they were, maybe they weren't, but I'm going to keep going. What do you say we talk about step 10? Because right now I've written here, I'm not here to argue with anybody or try to set anybody straight. I'd like to, but because, you know, one of the things I've noticed about with this newfound clarity is I have a terrible habit of wanting to judge people really harshly for not knowing something that I learned about 30 minutes ago. You know? I mean, am I the only one that experienced that? You know, I sat in middle-of-the-road meetings for 10 years, but now that I'm in the Big Book, I'm like, how can he not know that? You know, he's killing people, you know, and, you know, and that sort of thing. I'm like, we're going to keep going because one of my favorite lines is in step 10 where it says, our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. You know, so I got to look at how would I have liked to have been approached when I was the one sitting in those middle of the road meetings? How could you have gotten me interested in doing it out of the book? What would have, you know, because a lot of times if you scream at me, I don't always go, thank you. Thank you so much for clearing that up. You know, there are other forms of literature that sometimes I worry about the good standing in the way of the best. And one of them to me is the 12 and 12 Alcoholics Anonymous. Good book. I think the Big Book is our great book, though. I really feel like our solution is in the Big Book, and I worry that in some areas they've gotten into some of the stuff I hear in the rooms of AA is not AA at all. But then in the 12 and 12, well, I love that I've become very open-minded in the past few years. I've gotten to the point where I'm willing to say there's some good stuff in the 12 and 12. That's pretty open-minded, don't you think? I don't think a lot of it falls in the step 10 portion, but it says, it does say A's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And it goes on to say, and even in the 12 and 12, it says Alcoholics Anonymous became the basic text of the fellowship, and it still is. Bob likes to say that I act like Bill wrote, that God wrote the Big Book, and Bill wrote the 12 and 12 in his office. I mean, sometimes I'm not even convinced of that, but that's a whole other controversy. But whether or not, it says that these essays are designed to broaden and deepen our understanding of these steps, and I'll let you be the judge if it does it for step 10. Because a lot of times, one of the terms that I hear so much in AA is, if you bring up Evening Review in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's amazing how many people will go, oh, I'm glad we're talking about the 10th step. You know, I need to be doing more of the 10th step. Evening Review is squarely in the 11th step. But the 12 and 12 has kind of muddied the waters on that a little bit because in this 10th step in the 12 and 12, it discusses all the different kinds of inventory that we do. It talks about the spot check inventory, which is taken during the day, which is actually step 10. It talks about at day's end, we draw up an evening review, and then it goes off into a thing about debits and credits and gets into this moral scorecard that I don't see anywhere in the basic text, but it seems like it changes a little bit from its focus on selfishness and self-centeredness. And then it talks about a careful review of our progress since the last time, an annual house cleaning, an undisturbed self-overhaul and meditation. So it goes on to say that an emphasis on inventory is heavy only because a great many of us have never really acquired the habit of accurate self-appraisal. Once this healthy practice has become grooved, it will be so interesting and profitable that the time it takes won't be missed. On page 90, it talks about the spiritual axiom: whenever there's something wrong with me, and whenever I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. In our big book, it talks about my problems are basically of my own making. It's the same thought. But it says consideration of long-standing difficulties, this is in the 12 and 12, had better be postponed when possible to times deliberately set aside for that purpose. Then it transitions off into self-restraint, self-control. That's our long suit, isn't it? Self-control. And it goes into this evening review where it kind of turns it into a balance sheet where it's talking about debits and credits, and it gets completely away from self. Seems to have been eliminated in the 12 and 12 address to the evening review. It seems to have turned it into a moral balance sheet where we talk about these are some things I did that are good and these are things I did bad. Anyway, I know I've pissed off about half the room now, so if you love the 12 and 12, I'm for you, you know, and there's some great stuff in there. But let's get back to the big book, because when I go back to this thing about, I like to recap steps 1 through 9. I told Chad, I said, he saw where I put recap steps 1 through 9, and he goes, how long are you going to take to do that? And I was like, oh, you know, maybe 4 or 5 minutes. And he's like, oh, right. You can do 5 minutes on obviously, you know. But the difference in the way I was approaching the steps back then when I was acting like the problem with alcohol and is significant. And you can't really address step 10 without knowing this new direction that is in the big book that I didn't see for 17 years. You know, Carl does a beautiful job of talking about what it means to be an alcoholic. You know, that I have two problems: physical allergy, mental obsession. Those two things coupled together make me powerless over to taking the first drink. That's the hopeless condition of mind and body that we're trying to recover from. We roll into step 2. I don't usually spend a lot of time in step 2. The most important thing in step 2 is that I be convinced, like Chad was reading tonight, that on my own power I got no shot. This other power doesn't get interesting until I've had that step 1 experience where I'm convinced that my power has no chance. Right? If you've got alcoholism the way the book describes it, trying to stop it with willpower is like trying to stop a freight train with a butterfly net. It's woefully inadequate, you know. So then this power gets interesting. Now, here's where it gets interesting, because in the third step, the book takes this huge right turn that I missed for 17 years. One of the mistakes I see being made in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, assuming there are any mistakes being made in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could be way off the beam, and I may have a different opinion next year, but one of the problems I see is taking somebody right from the ABC, A, that I'm alcoholic and can't manage my own life, B, that probably no human power can relieve my alcoholism, and C, that God could and would if he were sought. And if you say, are you willing to believe that God could and would if he were sought? And when I said yes, we went right to the third step prayer and got down on our knees and did the third step prayer and started writing inventory. I missed this whole body of work from pages 60 to 63 about where it says the first requirement is that I be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I remember seeing that and going, that's got to only be in the fourth edition. I've never seen this before. Not only was I, when I say I missed a lot in the book, not only was I never convinced that my life run on self-will could hardly be a success, that line had never touched me. Right? So I'm working a program like the problem is alcohol, and the book is saying that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem, right? In all these meetings, I've been trimming the branches of my problem, talking about the things that when it says on that basis of self-will, I'm in constant collision with something or somebody. All we ever talked about in these meetings was constant collision. You know, that should be the topic for the meeting. What did you collide with today? You know, well, I'd like to talk about traffic. I'd like to talk about my divorce. I'd like to talk about my boss. I'd like to talk about, you know. But we were never getting down to the root of the problem. And that's what we got into with Mark and some of these guys was where it says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. And when it said above everything, we have to be rid of the selfishness. I remember Mark looking me dead in the eye and going, what does above everything mean to you? It doesn't say above everything I got to stop drinking vodka. or above everything, I've got to conquer fear, or above everything, it says above everything, I got to get rid of this selfishness, or I got no shot. So when we skip that self piece, is what I call it, from 60 to 63, it's not really that important. It's just the root of our problem and the basis of our work for the rest of our lives in recovery. Other than that, you can just skip it, you know. So I'm out there working the program like the problem is alcohol, and it never was. Alcohol was my solution. It was the only thing I ever found that would ease the pain of a life based completely on selfishness and self-centeredness. And it turns out that if I have that same life in recovery, those bedevilments are available to me in sobriety. The reason I try to work a program as hard as I do now is I know drinking is out there and it's available, but I don't want to go back to living in those bedevilments in sobriety. Those things on page 52 where it talks about having trouble with our emotional natures, having trouble with personal relationships, couldn't control our emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, couldn't make a living. Those are the things that I've lived in for years in sobriety, and I don't want to go back to that. The reason I bring all that up is because Ralph did a great job of talking about it in step four. I didn't see it for a long time, but I used to think step four was just trying to move the stuff that blocks me, that makes me feel bad. But what it really says is, if self is the problem, how does it show up? And 4 through 9 is about removing the manifestations of self that bother me. In the third step, it says, I got to get, if I stay close to him and perform his work well, he'll provide what I need. Well, I can't stay close to him until I get close to him. And the way we get close to him is in steps 4 through 9, removing what's blocking me from it. And we come out of there on step 10. And because it says at the end of those 9-step promises, are these extravagant promises? We think not. And I love it when, you got guys with 30 days going, we think not. I don't even want to get off on the chanting in the AA meetings. I mean, oh my God. I'm just going to say, if you're new, it's optional. It's not AA. You don't have to do it. That God could and would if he were sought. And you look around and you're like going, when did we start doing that? I'm sorry. I said I wasn't going to get off on that. But when it says, are these extravagant promises? We think not. You know who we is? We was them. I used to think we was me. We was us. We was those people who had experienced the spiritual awakening as a result of this work. They're the ones that are saying they think these aren't extravagant promises. When you're sitting where I was, they were damned extravagant promises. Fear of financial insecurity will leave me? What? I was way on the far side of that one, So they're saying that they experienced these promises as a result of doing this work out of this book. And that's the ones they're saying we think not. Not me rolling in off the street after with 30 days of treatment on me. So when we get into step 10, it says continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. What I didn't see for a long time is that the wrong that we're looking for in step 10 is, was it selfish or not? It wasn't, did I do something good or did I do something bad? It's looking at my actions throughout the day and saying, were they selfish or not? Because I can, it turns out that if I do something really cool with a selfish motive, it's still selfish. I used to think, self-seeking is all over me, and I am blind to it in myself. It's funny because I can point out, I got Chris here, Chris is one of my new guys. I love this guy. He is like pure alcoholism personified. When you want to see an extreme example of self-will run riot, we're thinking about doing a little carnival road show where he'd just be sitting in there with a cigarette and a big book, but you talk about, and I love you, Chris, and I love him because he just brings it. And every time he opens his mouth, it's just self-will run riot, So we don't have to work hard to find things to work on together, But the reason I bring that up is because I can spot selfishness and self-centeredness in Chris or Chad or Alex or Kent or Phil or Dane or any of these other guys. I'm blind to it in myself. Right? I got to have a sponsorship relationship where I'm willing to look at this stuff. And the way it's telling me in the 10th step, it gives me 4 things to look for, and it gives me 4 things to do about them. It says, This thought that these will materialize if we work on brings me to step 10, which suggests I continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as they go along. I vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. So there's a clear timing reference. I don't wait till I'm done with the ninth step. I start doing this while I'm cleaning up the past. And then it says, we have entered the world of the Spirit. How's that for a promise? You know, in 4 through 9, I've removed what's blocking me from this power, and now I can actually have conscious contact with this God that you guys are telling me is my only shot at getting sober. All right? Now I'm in the world of the Spirit. Mark used to say, by doing the work of 4 through 9, I've put my hand on a doorknob, and I've been able to enter a room that's the world of the Spirit. My job now is not to back out of that room. Because what will happen for me is self-will creeps back in. You know, and I'm doing the deal, and I don't know it, because what happens is God's will starts dropping down, self-will starts climbing up, and God's will starts dropping down. And before I know it, in sobriety, God ain't got nothing to do with the deal. I'm running this thing, and it's like, God's awesome, you know, and I'll bring him in if I ever get in real trouble, but I don't need him for this. You know, I don't need him for this thing with Katie, or this thing with my kids, or this thing with the money, or this thing at work. But if I ever run into a real problem, I'm bringing God right in, you know. So, and the way it rolls, it gives me four things to watch for as the reemergence of self. How does self show back up in my sober life? And it says we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Now I'm seeing these as the reemergence of self. How does self show back up in resentment? We had a guy in our group that used to call them the FDRs. Which is it backwards. Fear, dishonesty, resentment, selfishness. But whatever it is, I'm supposed to be watching. The 10th step has nothing to do with the end of the day. 10th step is throughout the day, because I can get up and do my morning meditation. Sheldon's going to talk about that tomorrow morning. But I can sit there and meditate for 15 minutes and read Emmett Fox and everybody else. And then when I go out in the world, it's game on. You know, and now all of a sudden selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear start cropping up, and I don't even know it. And I got to have somebody that I can call and say, I got a little 10-step call, Mike. You know, I do a lot of them with Mike. I do a lot of them with Katie. I do a lot of where I call up and I go, got a little resentful today. Got a little scared. I'm a little scared about this money thing. Hell, I've done 2 10-steps today on this talk. And it's still not going all that great, you know, but... kind of hoping you guys would laugh a little more during this last part, but if I don't call somebody, I remember calling this guy one time. I said, you know, I haven't really done any 10 steps lately or written much inventory, but I really think I'm doing pretty good. He goes, well, Charlie, I'd be careful about grading my own papers if I were you. That's cold. You know, that's some of that old-timer stuff where they just bam. You know, but when I'm grading my own papers, and I was talking to Mark about this morning, when you go back to the third step and everything I do is filtered through my motives and this delusion that I have that if everybody will do like I say, things will be wonderful. Well, when I run my actions through that funnel, that's one side of it is delusion, the other side of it is my motives, the worst time I'm ever going to give myself is an A-, you know. So I can spot selfishness and self-centeredness in some of my guys, or certainly in Katie, but... I don't see it in me. Now, Katie sees it in me, and I can call Mike, and he'll go, one time Chad, he had to come to me and go, Charlie, I'd like to offer something for your consideration. He goes, it looks to me like you're starting to run the show again. That's tough to hear from a sponsee, but, the, you know, we follow the path of consideration and spiritual consent, and we've made a deal with each other that if you see me doing something, you're welcome to come talk to me about it, whether it hurts my feelings or not. You know, and he came to me and goes, Charlie, you're acting like a guy that's running the show again. Because everybody was getting stupid, and everybody was starting to bug me, and I was starting to get a little easily frustrated and that sort of thing. You know, and it takes getting back down and writing inventory. You know, I'm not going to get around talking about half the stuff I want to talk about, but... It does say, continue to take personal inventory. That's one I think we can all agree on, right? Whether it's at the... I came from a school of AA. My first sponsor said, you only ever write 1 4th step. You only ever do 1 written inventory. Well, for a drunk like me, you don't have to say that to me too many times before I tap out. And I'm like, okay, 1 inventory it is. Well, you know, I mean... I believe now in multiple inventories. I believe in taking regular, ongoing inventory, and I also believe in multiple fifth steps. The book talks about person or persons who are going to hear our inventory. I like to write inventory and read it to two or three people. The last inventory I wrote, I read to three people. One of them was a woman. But I've really come to believe that the only people that are saying you only write one inventory are people who have only ever written one inventory. I don't think we've ever had anybody go, you know, I've written five or six in-depth inventories, and I really should have stopped at one. You know, I was wasting time on those. But the thing is, it's funny because there is a controversy. There's some discussion about whether going back and doing a four-column inventory. It talks about this major house painting where we set aside time for that purpose. I find those instructions in the fourth step. But a lot of people like to call it a tenth step. You know, they'll say, well, that, you know, you mean going back and doing a tenth step. I just call it writing inventory again. But one of the things that gets in my way is I think that when I go back and write inventory, it's going to be like the first time I wrote inventory, where there's 17 pages of resentments. Also, when I write inventory now, it's going to be four or five resentments and more fears. And then maybe, you know, look at my relationship stuff, and then I take it to somebody. It doesn't have to be this big, hairy deal. You know, it is true, but I don't care whether you call that a fourth step or a tenth step, you know, as long as you're writing the inventory. That's not the people that are having trouble in AA, is the people that are doing ongoing inventory. I don't care whether you call it a tenth step or a fourth step. Those, the people that are not doing it at all, are the ones that are out there suffering in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, is the people that are never doing inventory again. And, you know, it is true. I will say this. By the theory of the steps of the Big Book, if you did a perfect 10-step review every day, as you're going through the day, if you watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear, and you went through the four things it tells me to do about it, ask God to remove it, talk to somebody else about it, make amends quickly, turn my attention to somebody I could help, love and tolerance is my code, right? If you did that perfectly, you'll never have to do another written inventory for the rest of your life. And if you do that, we will build a statue in your honor in the front of the General Service Office, because the 10th step implies that we're going to screw up. It implies that going through life as sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to experience selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. I got to tell you about this one thing with Chris. He calls me one day, and he's talking about, he was mad because, I forget what it was, but we're talking about it, and he had asked God to remove it. I said, let's go through the instructions. Did you ask God to remove it? And he goes, yeah. And I said, and anyway, we went through the whole deal. And he goes, well, I'm going to call Chad about it. And I said, why are you going to call Chad about it? And he goes, well, what do you mean? I go, why you got to bother Chad with it? I mean, Chad's got his own life. He's got his own problems he's worrying about. And he goes, well, what do you mean? I go, let's look at the instructions, step 10. It says we ask God to remove it. We talk to somebody else about it. We make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. I said, then it doesn't say, then we resolutely turn our attention to somebody else we can talk to about it. You know, that's what we like to do. Self loves knowledge. And what I really want to do is talk to somebody until you give me an answer I feel comfortable with. On my own, without the process of this program, I'm a maniac in sobriety. You know, I've seen guys that it seems like they just sober up and everything is smooth for them, you know, but that's not my experience. I'm a guy that it seems like if I don't stay tuned in and keep turning back to the line, turning back to the line, turning back to the line, I drift off a little bit and then I turn back to the line. And if I'm not constantly checking myself and going to somebody else for accountability, by the end of the day, I'm heading off into right field and I don't even know it. You know, and I can roll that way for a long time. And so, you know, I'm a big believer in step 10. I think we ought to keep it. I just want to make sure I don't have a couple, you know, be careful where you get your advice. If you haven't been in the Big Book for a while, try doing the instructions right out of the Big Book. There are clear-cut directions in there that will work for a maniac like me, and I looked at every place but there for a long time. I'm so honored to get to have anything to do with this process or these people. if you're sitting in the rooms, the main thing I want to say is that one of my favorite quotes from Katie is she says that a moment of clarity that's not is of no value if it's not followed by action. We have a tendency to come to these workshops, we come to these treatments, and we get right up next to the solution. I hear that the solution is there. I get around people that are in the solution, and I think, my God, I even get some relief from knowing that the solution is still available to me. But then I go back home, and I fall back into my life, and I get back into my kids and my money and my problems and stuff like that. This is an action program. If you're sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're not feeling what you hear people say in their experience, it's still available. And it's available as a result of doing the work right out of this book. I love the line where it says, the most satisfying years of our existence lie ahead of us. Is that your experience? Does your current experience reflect that those are going to be, or is it possible that we could all be doing a little bit better if we really were practicing all the principles the way they're laid out in the book? Constant thought of others, constantly saying to ourselves many times each day, thy will, not mine. Current spot check inventory, evening review, morning meditation, doing all of my amends. I smell more. I think there's more available in this deal than what I was experiencing for a long time, and I'm so excited to get to be a part of it, and I want to thank you so much for asking me to come up here tonight. Thank you.